And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Fancast for you, and we're going to get into this whole notion of hammering out a coach's contract. And why would we talk about that, Drancer? Oh, it seems that the coach of the team that we covered is in need of a new contract. It was a hot button issue a couple of weeks back. It hasn't gone anywhere, but the talk has died down a little bit, and we'll see where things play out as far as Travis Green and a new deal for the Vancouver Canucks. I imagine that the hockey club wants a little direction first and foremost from the NHL about a return to play. So we're on top of it. We're certainly following that story still, but really it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot in the way of new development. But there was some hockey news that took place yesterday that tracks back to the Vancouver Canucks. And, like, we're not doing our jobs if we can't find news around the NHL and find a way to track it back to the Canucks, right?
Like, yeah, that's essentially
what we do.
Yeah, for sure. So, no, and I mean, look, I think the Mikhail Sergachev extension, it's 3 years, 4.8, so 14.6 all told, with the Tampa Bay Lightning, is an interesting data point. And here's why it's an interesting data point. Hughes is not a comparable piece to Sergachev. He's outscored him by a wide margin to this point in his career. Like, if he has six more points next season, which I think is safe to assume, like, he might do that in two games. He will have more points over the course of his entry-level deal than Sergachev does on his, and Sergachev will have had the benefit of playing a full three seasons on his entry-level deal. Hughes's will be two plus five games at the tail end of the 18-19 season. So for that reason alone, he's not a comparable. But he's also not a comparable at all because of his 10.2C status, right? Like, they're straight-up not comparable deals. Finally, you know, Tampa Bay, we all know, is a unique market for second contract players. They bridge everybody. They've got their own way of doing this. And from Kucherov to Vasilevsky to Braden Point to Sergachev, like, they always sort of come in below market. And for whatever reason, the market that Tampa sets never seems to be, like, the template that the Tampa Bay Lightning set with those types of bridge deals is not replicated elsewhere, right? Like, those deals do not seem to move or set the market. And I think that's, you know, for good reason for if you're an agent and a player. All of that said, there's a key data point that it indicates, which is that Sergachev's deal is essentially on par with those signed before the pandemic by McAvoy and by Zach Werenski, which suggests that there is no new market. There is no depressed post-pandemic market for high-end young contributors coming off their entry-level deals. And that means giddy up, the summer of the second contract defenseman with Miro Heiskanen and Rasmus Dahlin on the sort of lower end, like the more normal end. You can find real comps for them, right? Like, can you imagine? I'm saying Dahlin and Heiskanen on the lower end. Like, ridiculous.
Normal. I love that.
Yeah, because Hughes and Makar, right? Like, there's no precedent here, right? Like, we are in completely uncharted waters in terms of...
Yes.
Yeah, in terms of what they've accomplished and what they do on the ice and the way they score. So, you know, figuring that out, like, if you're a team lucky enough to employ one of those guys, man... This deal suggests to me that there's no new lower rung depressed market for these types of players. They're still going to be exorbitantly expensive, and teams are probably going to be happy to pay it because at least they're one of the four that employ players of this caliber.
You've written a new piece that's up at The Athletic now about Sergachev's deal and sort of how it relates to Hughes. And I liked one of the lines where you said, like, you know, in warm-up, Sergachev takes the third rotation through on the left side of the defense behind Victor Hedman and Ryan McDonagh. But he's, you know, he's certainly not a third pairing guy. You watched him through the bubble the last couple of rounds, obviously the Stanley Cup final as well. What do you like most about Sergachev's game?
Well, like, there's so much to like, right? Like, he's skilled, he's big, he's mean, he's fast. Like, you know, it's for a player like Sergachev, it's really the whole package, right? Like, it's that he does all of that. It's that, you know, this is a guy skilled enough that he didn't look out of place, even though he wasn't super effective there, playing the half wall on the power play. Like, you never see a defenseman in that spot, right? Like, that's where he played where JT Miller plays on the Canucks PP1, right? Like, for the Tampa Bay Lightning in the Stanley Cup final, like, on the big stage, he was often occupying that spot. That speaks to a really, really unique level of skill. And then you see him just absolutely drill a guy or battle in front of the net. And it's just like, oh, this guy is, you know, he's like Mario in Mario Kart or Mario Party, right? Like, he's fast enough to beat the big guys, and he's big enough to beat up on the small guys. Like, he kind of does everything. Jack of all trades. That, to me, is exactly what I want in, you know, a defender who, honestly, based on what he offers, like, I think this is a guy who, if he played in a, I mean, arguably for a worse team, actually not even arguably, if he played on a normal team, not a stacked juggernaut like the Tampa Bay Lightning, I think he's a signature 1A defenseman for 2/3 of the league. And I mean, that's a tremendous player, and a player who, coming off of this bridge contract, I'm sure will cash in at a major, major rate, especially if he continues to improve the way he did this past season, where he added just a level of defensive savvy that sort of eclipsed him in his first 2 years in the league. And that level of improvement, YOY, like, that to me is also a huge, huge indicator of a defender that's rather quickly figuring things out.
Yeah, and as it is with all these young players, and if it's in, you know, it turns out to be a bridge contract, you know, we look at the AAV and it's under 5, and then it's a steal for that kind of player, but it is the breakdown. And in Sergachev's case, it's 2.4, 4.8, and then 7.2 in that final year, the platform year for the qualifying offer moving forward. And so, yeah, I mean, that sets him up for a guaranteed big time payday the next time he has to go down that road. But again, and you know, you mentioned it, like, the Bolts, everybody talking about this cap hell that they're in. I mean, this is just a fine, fine piece of business to get that player locked up at that price point, but they still certainly have some work to do. And I know that, you know, everybody else around the NHL is going to watch to see where it goes from here for Tampa and how creative they can get with, they've got,
yeah,
you know.
They've, I mean, still got Cirelli and Cernak. And,
yeah, yeah.
It's nuts. So, it's nuts. And they're $2 million over the cap now. So, yeah, I mean, they might, you know, they might have to do a turkey salary dump, a different type of turkey dump. Black Friday sale. Tampa Bay Lightning hosting it. All the best Black Friday sales are in Florida, trust me. But yeah, no, let's pivot from the turkeys to the lame ducks, though, shall we?
All right, hang on. We'll put the coaching talk aside here. Neil Glasper is going to join us, and we'll get into coaching contracts in a sec here. But you mentioned JT Miller. I don't know if you saw, Kuz had a piece, I thought, pretty revealing. We haven't heard from JT Miller since the end of the season, and we learned in that piece, like, if the Canucks had advanced, if they had beaten Vegas and moved on to the Western Conference Final, they may have had to go to work without JT Miller, who, as it turns out, you know, we never know what guys are going through, right? Like, no. We watch these guys, fans cheer for them, we sit there and critique and assess and everything else. we don't know what they're dealing with. And JT Miller, I thought, really candid and opened up to Ben Kuzma in the province and admitted that, you know, as the Canucks were battling Vegas, his mother-in-law was being put into hospice care back in the Pittsburgh area. And, you know, these guys are away from their family. So JT's wife is having to deal with, you know, the imminent death of her mother. And he can't be there for her. And through it all, like, the guy tied for the team lead in points in the playoffs, 18, had nights where he was the best player on the ice. And, you know, I think, too, there was always that talk of, was he playing through something? I think, you know, he wasn't taking faceoffs at the rate that maybe he normally did. And, yeah, he was playing through something. He was playing through something that, you know, remarkably personal that he was able to compartmentalize and still perform at that level. So, you know, you have to tip your cap to a guy like that for being able to sort of focus on the task at hand. But, I just, you know, pulling back the curtain, that was a part of the story that I just did not know.
No, me neither. And an incredible testament to the sacrifice that went into competing for the Stanley Cup away from families, right? Away from the real world, effectively, in the bubble in Edmonton, from a variety of people involved in the league, JT Miller included. You know, I think that's sort of one big takeaway. And the other that I had is after, it was Alex Tuck scored on a, no, it was Stasny, but it was Tuck's initial shot. And it was Quinn Hughes stopped the Tuck attempt, and then Stasny deposits it into the empty net, and it's 2-0 Vegas with 3 minutes to play in game seven. And I remember being struck by the emotion that JT Miller showed, and the cameras didn't capture it because they were focused on the goal celebration for Vegas, but JT almost broke his stick over the net, and then he leaned on the back of the net just staring out into space for, I swear, like 45 seconds. Like, he almost had to be peeled away. And knowing now what I know, knowing now what Kuz uncovered there and what JT was going through, that entire episode has a totally different resonance for me, based on, you know, what Miller's family was going through in that moment. So tremendous work by Kuz, great interview, and good on JT for being that candid about a really difficult subject. In addition to saying some really interesting things about some of the departures and his reaction to the Canucks offseason all around.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, mother-in-law, 58. With brain cancer, just way too young. Like, terrible story. But, yeah, I mean, look, we know the JT Miller story about taking a guy like Vertanen under his wing and, you know, working with him and seeing some of himself, a younger JT, in Jake Vertanen. And you could read, like, I didn't think there was a lot of room for interpretation. Like, he sounded frustrated that all these veteran teammates have left and that, you know, basically that he's going to have to be a part of, you know, this youth movement, but I'm sure he'll do his part. But, you know, I mean, look, he speaks from the heart. There's no filter with JT. I think we both know that. We've seen that enough times. I wasn't surprised that he sort of, I don't know if he vented necessarily, but I thought made it pretty clear that, you know, he was disappointed that, and that some of these young guys better be as good as advertised by management. Like, that was kind of my takeaway from that quote. Like,
yep,
management better know what they're doing here.
Yeah, well, the other thing to note, I think there's two things that are interesting to me about what Miller said there. And one is, you know, I wonder how much of that is an echo of frustration. Like, you move on from a Tampa Bay Lightning team that then wins the Cup, right? You feel like you're on a team that's still on the rise, though, right? Like, you might have your shot. And, you know, then you lose Markstrom and Tanev and Toffoli. And, you know, you can understand how that would be so difficult for a player who's lived through what JT has and sacrificed what JT has over the past, you know, 15, 16 months. You know, really dating back even to when he was traded. And the other part of it that, you know, I think is worth bringing up, and I was surprised by this, JPAT, but I started another piece that I wrote this week with a note about how, for all of the players the Canucks lost, for all of the turnover that they've dealt with, like, 8 of their 10 most frequently used skaters, you know, which doesn't include Toffoli, based on average ice time a game in the playoffs, are returning, right? Like, that when I sort of noticed that, I was just mind blown. Like, other than Tanev, and who was third, and Stetcher, who was eighth, like, really, the top end or the core group of this Canucks team that performed the way they did in the playoffs is returning. Like, really, it's Markstrom who is the core piece that they lost. And otherwise, you know, it feels like the Canucks have had more turnover than they have in fact, which I was just struck by. Like, I didn't quite understand or compute that in my head until I sort of looked at it in that manner. But, you know, it sort of suggests to me that when I think about what this club has done, like, the depth issues persist, which is frustrating, but the top six should still be really good. The top four is better. The real risk is that they're not going to be healthy. And definitely they've taken a step back, and a step back that shouldn't be minimized in goal. But, I mean, there is still a path for this team to probably not take a step forward over what they did in 1920, whenever the NHL returns, but to at least be solidly competitive in an all-Canadian division. It's just that, man, they are going to be leaning on a level of good health that they did enjoy this past season, but that is not typical of this organization.
Right, and I do think that point has to be underscored, that, you know, Pettersson and Miller and Horvat and Hughes, aside from the one night, like, they were there every game, game in, game out, and can you bank on that? Probably not, right? Like, there are going to be some injuries along the way, and we'll knock on wood for everybody's health here, but to think that you're going to have your best players available to you every single night, it's just, it's pro sports, it's a battle out there, and guys mm-hmm. do get injured, so just keep that in mind. Hey, just one quick thing here before we move on to our guest here. You know, at the end of every podcast, I always solicit feedback from our listeners, and I wanted to share this one, because I thought this was terrific. This was posted on the Athletic app, and it's from Megan C, and it says, "I love this podcast. I accidentally discovered that I love hockey and the Canucks this year." I'd love to know the backstory, how you accidentally discover that you love hockey, but it says, "I've been listening religiously since I discovered the VanCast. Seriously, I listened to some episodes several times over. Sorry if that messes with your metrics." So, that makes Megan a hardcore listener right there.
Thanks, Megan.
Listening to the same episodes over and over, damn the metrics. Who cares? We'll take your repeated listens. She just went on. She said, "I wanted to let you know that I appreciated the laughs this week. Your takes on tortoises and turtlenecks was just what I needed. I live in Nebraska, and this state isn't just unwilling to turn slightly to avoid the cliff. They're pedal to the metal, blindfolds on, full speed ahead, barreling towards the edge, her anxiety at an all-time high, and for whatever strange and unexpected reason, listening to the both of you talk Canucks hockey has sort of become her happy place." So,
aww. Thanks, Megan.
Yeah, thanks, Megan, absolutely.
That's why we do it.
Exactly. If it means talking turtlenecks, we'll do it to keep the people happy.
But will you wear a turtleneck, J-Pat?
No, God, no.
Come on.
No.
Come on.
My days of turtleneck. No, my days of... I'm generally anti-sweater at the best of times, but certainly when it comes to turtleneck.
Anti-sweater? Come on. Yeah. You're anti-sweater?
Do you remember just the fact that... Yeah, anti-sweater. Just leave it at that.
That's ridiculous. Move on. Leave it at that.
I'm anti-sweater.
You live in Canada. How can you be anti-sweater? Yeah, man, I wear sweaters every day.
I run warm, like, generally. Yes. Oh, no, man. I run warm. So.
You run warm. Oh, my goodness.
Yes. That the fact is that wild. Megan mentioned she's from Nebraska. Do you remember, how could you forget, the Axarben Knights, the Flames affiliate? Like, one of the worst names in hockey?
Yeah.
And, like, there are people out there that still don't realize that Axarben is Nebraska backwards, right? So, anyways, I just like the fact that she accidentally became a hockey fan, but we're happy to have her. More the merrier, and hopefully you'll continue to support the VanCast here, Megan.
Even if J-Pat continues to be anti-sweater, she should exactly. Megan, I suggest a protest. You should stop listening unless J-Pat wears a turtleneck. Do us all a favor. We need to get you in a turtleneck, man. Some nice cashmere. I know what I'm getting you for Christmas.
Yes, keep listening, because Niamh Vassberg is going to join us here shortly, and we're going to talk a little bit about Travis Green and a new contract for him. Now, Neil doesn't represent Travis, just want to make that clear, so we will get into sort of the dynamics of hammering out contracts for coaches, and we'll see where it goes as far as Travis Green is concerned, but certainly 1 year left on his contract, so he's in the market for a new deal, and we'll see if he and the Canucks can find some common ground.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Neil Glassberg is the founder and CEO of PBI Sports. He's a sports executive, a brand builder, a consultant, and among his many skills and duties, he also represents coaches and managers in contract negotiations. He has clients in a number of different sports, including the National Hockey League, although we will say he does not represent Travis Green. So if you're looking for the inside scoop on what's going on with the Canucks head coach right now, that's not the object of this exercise. We're trying to give our listeners a general idea of what goes into contracts for coaches and how that process differs from player negotiations. Neil, thanks so much for taking a little time and joining us here on the VanCast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Do you see yourself as an agent? I mentioned the many things that you do, but if I call you an agent, am I right?
Should be an easy question to answer. So the easy answer is yes, although in the space that you mentioned where I focus all my time and energy, being coaches and management, I really view myself more as a personal brander than an agent, as one would define agent. But I do all of the stuff that agents do plus. How's that?
Yeah, that works for me. So as we focus, I mean, this is a hockey-focused pod. So, you know, in the purposes of this with you here, I think we'll spend most of the time dealing in the hockey realm. I just wonder, like, player salaries, there's full disclosure. Everybody knows what every player across the board makes. That's not the case with coaches. How does that present a challenge for you when you're trying to hammer out deals for a coach?
So challenge is a good word. It actually, because of the focus, just to sort of delineate or differentiate what I do versus an NHL PA agent, of which all agents are, you know, they're all part of the same union as the players, we're an independent group. So none of the coaches or management in the NHL are part of any collectively bargained agreement, which makes every negotiation independent. So the fact that numbers aren't public poses a challenge to anybody new to this industry in doing what I'm doing. But once I've been in it, and based on the let's say hundreds of contracts that I've negotiated, I have access to my own proprietary database to know what everybody is being paid. So challenge for any new entrants. Advantage for someone like myself that's been in this space, that is in this space exclusively, to know what the benchmarks are and know what the limitations might be for certain teams.
Neil, with coaching negotiations, like, because it's outside the collective bargaining agreement, there's no term limits. There's, you know, a variety of different things you can do. I often say, just to make it clear for readers, like, whereas standard player contracts are prescribed relatively narrowly, in contrast, coaching negotiations can be the Wild West with everything from ratchets to, you know, what have you. What makes it so distinct that maybe the public wouldn't be aware of?
It's interesting he'd refer to this as the Wild West. not sure that's the term I would use, but I get it. I totally get where you're coming from. The beauty and the fun of what I do for a living is the creativity that goes into negotiating a contract for a coach or someone on the management side. And when I say creativity, it's not infinite. There are limitations on the amount of creativity. But the beauty, as I said, the beauty of what I do is almost the customization of the comp package that is completely 180 degrees, you know, diametrically opposed mm-hmm. from how prescribed limits work in a CBA, environment. So the what it really comes down to is, who is the team? What is the team's budget or affordability? Who is the candidate that they're contemplating hiring, and how creative can we be to sort of match the client or the candidate to the environment? But mm-hmm. that's based on a whole host of attributes. It's not something as simple as salary or a bonus. You know, you mentioned the word ratchet. Sure, there are, you know, there are escalator. I mean, there are different terms for the same thing. Escalator clauses. And what is the situation of the team at that point in time? So in other words, if they're in the middle of a, I'll use the word rebuild, not that it means much to me, but, you know, if a team is young and in a rebuild, that may affect the term that a coach is going to be offered, because the first couple of years might be get us to the playoffs as the number one priority, or not even, just get us into the 5 to 550 winning percentage mark, and we'll take that. So it's all relative to past performance versus what the expectations are of the ownership and management to on a short-term basis, mid-term basis, and long-term basis. Ultimately, everyone wants to win the Stanley Cup. We get that. That's a no-brainer. The question is, what's the path to get there?
And Neil, I also want to ask you, because we've seen more attention given to coaches' contracts, and I feel like the genesis of that really was the Babcock deal in Toronto, right? Like, since then, there's been more focus on coaches' salaries, and there also seems to be more of a sort of sense, at least that I get among coaches, that you're trying to raise the bar for everybody, right? That a rising tide floats all ships. Have you noticed that working with NHL coaches over the past decade?
So the quick answer is absolutely. There has been a steady increase in coaches' salaries over the past, you know, few years. I really need to give a plug to the NHL Coaches Association, that's run by Mike Hirschfeld, who has done a really nice job, not in a union way, but a really nice job in a collective, loosely held way, of working with the league on certain things like coaches' pensions and some medical benefits and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that credit, does go to someone like Mike Babcock, who has been intimately involved in the Coaches Association for years, has been, I would argue, a lot of the driving force behind the association, which, you know, was run by one of my clients. It's the Stanley Cup winner that runs the association as the president,
right?
Every couple of years. So Mike Sullivan was the past president. Craig Berube is the current president. And the Coaches Association has done a nice job, in a passive way, I would argue, but they've done a nice job helping move the, or shift, you know, have the pendulum shift a little from where coaches' salaries used to be to where they are today. So did Mike Babcock's big contract in Toronto change the world for coaches? No. Did it help? Absolutely.
Hey, Neil, when you're hammering out a deal for an NHL head coach, are you dealing primarily with his immediate boss, the general manager, or do you deal with ownership?
On a head coaching deal, the preponderance would be working with the general manager. There have been occasions where, depending on how involved an owner is, I may not be negotiating with the owner directly, but they are taking a very active role in the where we land. So there's no written rule. It's really organization dependent. There are some owners that are very involved. I would argue from a micro perspective, they're too involved, but that's their prerogative. It's their, you know, it's their asset, it's their investment. They can choose to do whatever they want. But I would say that in the strong majority of cases, I'm negotiating with the general manager and not the owner.
As the old adage goes, coaches are hired to be fired, right? There is going to come an end for just about every coach in his current position. How much variance is there in the departure or the dismissal part of the contract? And I think a lot of people wonder, when a coach gets fired, like, how does that work in term, you know, if he's still got a bunch of years left on his deal? How much difference is there from contract to contract?
So let me sort of educate at the same time, totally respectfully. Yeah. All of these coaches sign employment agreements, which are standard employment agreements that, you know, that a lot of people sign in various jobs. in the employment agreement are standard clauses, of which termination with cause and termination without cause are in there. So it's the clauses that lay out the what happens upon termination. And, you know, if a coach is fired, I hate that adage, by the way, coach is being hired to be fired. I know it's true, but I hate saying it. But there are contract terms that kick in upon termination. Now, you know, thankfully, most of the terminations are without cause and not with cause, because that's a whole different kettle of fish. But when they're terminations without cause, the employment agreement kicks in, of which all of the continuing rights and obligations and entitlements continue per the agreement. I don't know if I answered your question. I mean, that's contract law 101. So there's nothing unique to that. As I said, termination with cause is a whole different story.
And Neil, I also want to ask you, because coaches' salaries tend to be pretty stratified in the NHL at the moment, right? You sort of have a pretty standard template for the first time NHL bench boss. You know, we all sort of know what those deals look like, you know, somewhere between 8, 1.2, and maybe if a guy has a lot of leverage because they're a long tenured college coach or what have you, they'll get a bit more. And then you've got the guys who've won cups or been around for a decade and are established names. And, you know, we all know what's happened to those salaries. They've exploded. We're talking 5 million plus for an awful lot of bench bosses these days. But that middle ground is, or at least seems to be, less well trod at the moment. What difficulties does that pose for coaches in that mid-range looking to maximize their sort of fair compensation on subsequent deals, whether it's with the team that they're working with or, you know, in getting a new opportunity?
That's actually a really interesting question. And as I think I laid out at the beginning, a lot of what I do is customization of compensation. And what I mean is that the situation, the financial position, and the political strategy or approach that an organization takes differs amongst the 31 teams. So there's some relativity. In other words, Coach A is getting paid salary X with a team. If I do my job right, I'm presenting comparables, you know, to an organization to sort of build a case, a business case, because that's how I put all this stuff together. It's not just pick a number out of the air. I do business case all of my coaches to say these are the right comparables. So it almost has a look and feel, and I don't take this you know at face value, but it almost has a look and feel of an arbitration case for an NHL player, right? So the arb cases are very much the sell mode that agents go into versus the team, right? To present comparables, to figure out what number makes sense in the form of a compromise. Player wants X, team's prepared to offer Y, where do they settle, right? In my case, it's almost like every negotiation is an arbitration case because, you know, I'm trying to present comparables that make sense so that my clients get paid the most that they should be, that they deserve, without compromising, so to speak. However, I have to take into consideration the individual team's abilities, if that makes sense. So, you know, it's not a barter. It's not an arbitration. It's trying to figure out the right market value for that coach in that situation. So I gave you a lot of words there, not to overcomplicate it, but the fun part is the creative part or the customization to say, okay, if we can't do this, what can we do on points B, C, D, and E? And I will tell you, just not to speak ad nauseum here, but I'm a huge fan in variable compensation, because to me, that is not money at risk. Variable compensation, just for your listeners to understand, is that if the team makes the playoffs, or if the team does well, or if the team presents a top power play or top PK, or a whole bunch of other variables, one would argue that that should translate into better performance. Better performance generally leads to longer duration, i.e. playoffs. So the better performance should translate into more money in the pocket of the coach. That's the variable compensation model. So it's only money at risk for a team if the performance isn't there. If the performance is there, people should get paid for it. That's the long-winded answer.
We have mentioned a couple of times already that, you know, you've represented John Tortorella, and obviously you're talking to a Vancouver, for the most part, listener base here on the VanCast, people that are hardcore as far as the Canucks are concerned. So, you know, we all got our dose of Torts a few years back. What's he like as a client?
So John is you know, again, the different environments, right? Let's not rehash the whole Vancouver experience. You know, and Mike Sullivan was a key member of his staff then, and you know, I represent Mike, and Mike has done a fantastic job sort of rebranding. This didn't just happen, by the way, basically separating his brand from John. Not that it was a bad thing, but Mike has done a great job building up his own personal brand, as evidenced by his, you know, the performance in Pittsburgh, which I don't need to share over the last few years. But I think one would argue that he's done a fantastic job, you know, in returning the Penguins back to winning. John is a fantastic coach, very demanding, and he is a very and his expectations are quite high. So is he intense? Absolutely. But you know, you're better off asking players that have played for him than me, because of course my answer is somewhat biased. But you know, John has had tremendous success in this league, in every environment he's been in. And his expectations of his players, I think would be fair to say, are there. And you know, when you play for Torts, that there's no nights off. So it's go, go, go. And as I said, I think that what I say would be echoed by anyone that's played for him in any organization. And quite frankly, that's the job of a coach, is to keep people motivated and make sure they're performing night in and night out. So, you know, he is who he is, and you either love him or you hate him, but he's going to make you better as a person, and he's going to make you better as a player.
Neil, we have established that you have a stable of clients in the National Hockey League. I would imagine that all coaches now have some sort of representation, but that hasn't always been the case. My guess is for quite a while, it was sort of the coach just dealing straight on with the general manager. Just in your time in this business, how has that whole process of representing coaches grown and changed?
So, just historically, the other two professional sports leagues in North America, both the NBA and the NFL, have had people like myself representing coaches and management forever, probably 25 years. The NHL is a late bloomer with respect to people like me representing the interests of a coach and management. So they all used to do their deals on their own. Or if they had played, they might use their former player agent to help them, but that's against the rules of the NHLPA. So no player agent is allowed to represent a coach or management in any negotiation with an NHL team. That is in the NHLPA constitution. I'd like to say that it's respected 100% of the time, but I won't get into just read between the lines as to whether or not that happens. But that being said, I think that in the last, you know, say 8 years or so that I've really been doing this in the NHL and have really grown my, you know, my portfolio, my roster, there is a much better understanding and appreciation for the value add of someone like me in a negotiation. You know, the example I use with a lot of people is that, you know, how comfortable are you negotiating your own mortgage? Never mind your own compensation package. So that becomes an aha moment for people. And in a lot of cases, you know, if you think of the emotional input in negotiating one's own compensation package, there are so many opportunities for things to go off the rails and so many opportunities for there to be confrontation. Because I say I'm worth X, my employer says I'm worth Y. How do you have that conversation, removing the emotion, to say, when your employer says you're not worth what you think you are, number one. Number two is, I've always found it difficult, and this is 27 years of, you know, my large corporate experience, having been a CEO several times. How can you go in and say and tell your employer that you know what your peer group that work for other different organizations are making? I mean, salaries are supposed to be confidential. So how do you go in and say, I should be getting paid X because my guy on this team is getting paid Y with this team? Like they're sort of like it becomes a little bit of an awkward moment in a discussion. And I always say that any of these awkward moments are very hard to eliminate. So if you get into a little bit of a brouhaha with your employer on compensation, people have long memory. Like those things sit there, mm-hmm. and it becomes, you know, the elephant in the room more often than it needs to. Let's put it that way, which is the beauty of having someone like myself that is representing both sides, obviously representing my client who's paying my bill, but I'm the one that's representing what my client is feeling, or I'm the one that's representing what I feel the business case market value is.
Neil, I just want to ask you a little bit about the pandemic and what impact you've seen in terms of, you know, how teams are adjusting to the new reality that, you know, they're facing in these hopefully short-term challenges of not being able to rely on gate revenue, and what knock-off effects that's had in your view on, you know, some of these negotiations or on coaching compensation.
So a couple of things happened. One is there were coaches that were on contracts that were expiring on June 30th, 2020. So when the pandemic kicked in March, in a lot of ways, nobody likes to be working in the last year of their contract. It's kind of like a feel-good moment or a job security moment. But there were coaches whose contracts were expiring at the end of June. Given the teams had no revenue and the season was shut down, there were a lot of provisions that were put in place to extend coaches beyond that June 30th deadline to allow them to coach in the bubble.
Right.
Okay. So there were temporary extensions put into place to make sure that these guys were paid through the time that they spent in the bubble. That caused some issues for some teams because there was no race with the uncertainty we were facing for any team to go out and extend a coach into next season, like the 2021 season or beyond, because nobody knew when we were going to be starting up. Case in point, here we are November 26th, and we still don't have, we have a hope for a date, but we don't have anything carved in stone in terms of when we get going again. So what it did is it basically gave teams the ability to say, we're going to get through the bubble. We don't know what 2021 looks like, so we're not going to offer you a contract right now until we know when we're starting up. So that became, I mean, that still exists today for some coaches who know they're going back, but they don't have a contract right now. And that's because if you're an owner of a team, what was the rush to sign somebody to a contract to basically sit on their couch until the season gets started? So hiring decisions have been deferred. New contracts are sort of sitting, waiting for a start date before they're offered. So the long-winded answer is the pandemic has caused a lot of stress and strain, not only to coaches and more coaches than management, but scouts, you know, who right. were basically also extended to get through the draft, who are now kind of wondering if they have a full-time gig when the season gets going. So we're in uncharted territory, and we're in unprecedented decision-making mode constantly right now. And, you know, along with that goes an element of stress. I mean, you know, we're all living through lockdown number two. People don't have contracts. They don't all have jobs. In some cases, they're being offered less money than their existing or their past contract because of the, you know, the revenue shortfall. And, you know, the NHL and NHLPA is in sort of negotiation mode right now. And I can't opine on that because I'm just a fan, but you know, there are some real discussions going on as it relates to the lack of revenue or the revenue shortfall and how that translates into an employment agreement.
And we've talked a lot, you know, on this over the course of this interview, you know, you've touched on ratchets, variable compensation, but as things move forward, right, are creative solutions going to become even more important in your view in finding ways to get coaches compensated fairly and appropriately?
I think the extent of the creativity is somewhat limited. Let's put it that way. We're dealing with an unknown, and the unknown is what does the revenue look like for each team? Are fans going to be allowed in the building at all out of the gate? Or is it going to be a ramp up? Is it going to transition? So I don't know. I would hope that there's an appetite for creativity because common sense tells me that's the time to be creative. But, as a case in point, here we are November 26th. We haven't started the season yet. We're going to start hopefully in, sooner than later. I don't know how much negotiation is going to take place. I think a lot of 2021 is going to be a let's just get through 2021 and worry about the real world and some sort of normalcy for 21-22. I mean, I hate to admit that, but I think that's reality.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all in that same boat that we all just want hockey back, and it's the question of how do we get it there and how do the two sides find that common ground and hopefully see a bigger picture and brighter days out of this pandemic. Neil, terrific overview. I mean, a fascinating topic that doesn't get touched on an awful lot, but again, it's a hot-button issue here in Vancouver these days because Travis Green is entering the final year of his contract, and we just see at this level that guys generally don't work into the final year of their contract without an extension. So we thought, let's explore this topic a little bit. And you've done a terrific job of providing us the details there, filling in some of the blanks. So I really appreciate you taking some time to join us here on the VanCast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. And I apologize for the long-winded answers, but as you can see,
it's fascinating.
We're all managing through unprecedented times. So I'd rather give your listeners the big perspective, opinions aside, so that everyone feels better, smarter, and more educated.
Perfect. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for being here. We really appreciate it.
Okay, guys. Stay healthy. Be well.
That was Neil Glassberg, again, the founder and CEO of PBI Sports. You can follow him on Twitter at PBI Sports, and some great insight. And again, it's timely, it's topical to answer because we're all sitting here waiting, thinking at some point there's going to be a little bit of news on the Travis Green front.
Yeah, and, at some point there has to be, right? Like, in this market, with the way we cover this team, with the changes that have been made, right? Like, considering how young this roster is going to be, like, you kind of need to make sure that it's being coached with the long view in mind, right? Like, this doesn't make sense to have this season with this team, with this number of young players being counted on in big roles, from Demko to Yolevi to Gaudette, and on and on, without someone who's bought in for the long term, right? Like, it just doesn't make sense. So you would expect some news at some point, perhaps not before we have some clarity on what the season looks like. However, it's hard to imagine that they would go into the season with, the primary spokesperson for the organization on the last year of their deal.
Right, and I think the other thing, too, is that they've got to find a replacement for Manny, so there's a coaching vacancy on Travis Green's staff. You would think, just to make everything work properly here, that you'd want the head coach to have some security before you go and hire his assistant, right? Like a new assistant, and I would think a new assistant would be a little skeptical if he comes in, takes a job. I know it's a job in the NHL, but if the head guy is working with this cloud of uncertainty around him, what does that mean for his future? And ultimately, what would that mean for the new guy's future? So there are a couple of moving parts at play here.
Yeah, and not to mention the fact that a bunch of assistants, right, in Newell Brown, Nolan Baumgartner, and goalie Coach Ian Clark are all on, the last year of their deals too. I think there's a variety of those gentlemen who the club, should be looking to lock up. I mean, Newell Brown just had the best goal differential on the power play of any coach in the NHL. And obviously in Clark's become the goalie whisperer, right? With an outsized reputation in this market. I don't know that you can lock any of those guys up until the head guy's done, and we'll sort of see where that goes. But at some point here, especially once we have clarity on when the league will return, if it will at all, I expect the pressure ramps up a bit for the deal to get done in, the ordinary course, to make things placid and normal going into training camp.
I had a good chat with Jim Benning yesterday, and among the things I was asking about the assistant coach and just the timing of sort of where they are with that, and he admitted that they're down to a short list now, but it seemed, and he didn't come out right out and say it, but you know, I don't think they're going to hire until they have a sense of when the season's going to get up on and running. I don't think they want to onboard anybody. This is an organization that's just laid off a bunch of staff, so I don't think they're looking to, you know, bring new employees in until they have a better sense of what's going on. But just quickly, you know, we talked about a bunch of things, and there wasn't really any sort of earth-shattering news to break here on the podcast, but I thought this was funny that at one point Jim was like, he agreed, like, we all need hockey back, and then he's like, and I don't think he was talking about our last podcast, but maybe he was. He's like, yeah, you know, I see everybody's talking about these turtles that, you know, like, and that just cracked me up that even the GM recognizes that that's where we are right now in the news cycle is with Braden Holtby and his tortoises. So then I followed up with, have you seen the Gaudette video? And there was this big roar of laughter from the other end of the phone from the general manager of the Vancouver Canucks, who admitted, yes, he had seen Adam Gaudette with the roundhouse kick that wound up in the side of his wife's head on their wedding video. God. So anyways, again, we all need hockey back in a hurry here.
Yes.
That's what we're left to deal with. But I just thought that it was pretty funny that even Jim's seen that video.
The big guttural laugh, that's great. Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. Well, good that you found him in good spirits. And, you know, I think better spirits, I'm sure, although the stress will ramp up again on Canucks management when the season begins, just because that's how this league works, right? Yeah. But, you know, I think hopefully on the other side of Thanksgiving, we can get some momentum going again in terms of the NHLPA and the NHL working toward a solution here, working toward a way to make this all work. And, you know, I mean, an all-Canadian division, like, the thing is if we do get hockey, it sounds delicious, right? Like, a shortened season, an all-Canadian division, like, let's go. I just hope that they can make the dollars and cents line up and sign a square deal for all sides, because, man, that sounds great. Like I want that intravenous. Like, give it to my veins. That's exactly what I want to get me through, you know, the back half of wave number two this year, especially.
60 games, you know, a 7-team Canadian division. So you would play the other six opponents 10 times. And then if you qualify for the playoffs, you're looking at a best of seven against one of those teams that you have just played 10 times. Like, it Amazing. Takes you right back to the late 1980s Western Hockey League when they had like the best of nine playoff series. The New West Bruins used to always play the Victoria or whoever, you know, a best of nine after having played them like 15 times during the regular season. But that's where we Yikes. Are in all of this. And if that's what it takes to get us hockey back, then hey, sign me up. I'm all for it. You mentioned momentum. One thing that doesn't need momentum, but we'll certainly give it a good plug here anyhow, is you've opened up the mailbag again. I see that you're soliciting questions for the next mailbag whenever you get around to writing the piece, but already it looked like a number of entries, a number of submissions, so that's good, but there's never enough, right? You can always take more.
No, come on. VIPs, go to the mailbag, submit your questions. I think we're up to 75 right now, nice. So I've got a lot to work with. I've already started working on a bunch of it. But I will run down, if you ask a question, if you have a Canucks question, like, I will run it down. Like, I will call my sources. I will analyze things that I haven't thought of. I will spend time unpacking something like 10 or 15 of the best. I'm going to go long. Like, it's Thanksgiving weekend in the United States anyway. I'll go long so that there's a ton of, you know, stuff to chew on over the course of the weekend. But yeah, get your question in now. I will honestly attack it with a serious level of aggression in unpacking it as best I can, as if it were my own thought, my own question, my own curiosity. Like, that's what I promise you, VIPs. So submit your question now to be considered.
Nice. And if there's some spillover, maybe we'll you know, you said Thanksgiving weekend, you know, leftovers, maybe we'll have to go down that road for an upcoming, and we will, because we had great success with that previous mailbag a couple weeks back, so something we'll look at as well. I just want to mention as well, Two Man Advantage Pod is back. You've got Scott Burnside and Pierre LeBrun this week talking to Kendall Cohen Schofield, who was hired this week as the new development coach for the Chicago Blackhawks, so you can check that out. Also, always look for our comment section for each podcast episode at the Athletic app, and rate and subscribe the VanCast on Apple. And starting on Black Friday, go to theathletic.com/VanCast. You can receive an all-access subscription for just $1 a month. Yeah, $1 a month for all 12 months. Offer is good through December the 4th. So busy program here. We thank Neil Glassberg for stopping by. Fascinating to hear him talking about coaching contracts. And as always, to our American listeners, have a great Thanksgiving weekend. To the rest of you, it's a VanCast weekend, so we can go back and digest this one again. For Grant, it's JPAT. As always, thanks so much for your support and for listening to the VanCast here at The Athletic and TheAthletic.com.